You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
In China, 1,000 new cars a day clog the roads, replacing bicycles. India has its new people's car. Everyone, everywhere in the world, wants to follow America. But the fossil-fueled world is threatened by oil shortages, high prices, and remorseless climate change. The jet stream is moving north. The Arctic ice sheet already has fatal cracks. Storms stir the earth. In this Radio EcoShock program, we ask, can America change the model of the world? Can the United States reinvent itself? Or will it go broke first, going under with a last gasp of war and militarism? I'm Alex Smith. We have two guest interviews for you. Professor Michael Clare, author of Blood and Oil, and now a new book, Rising Powers, Shrinking Planet. And Bruce Gagnon, a campaigner against weapons in space. Both are passionate peace activists. Both address the true cost of the alleged new American century. And both call for a switch from massive military spending to a plan for survival of life as we know it. In between, we'll join a conversation with Dmitry Orlov, author of the new book, Reinventing Collapse, The Soviet Example and American Prospects. I was in Berlin just after the wall fell. A visit to East Berlin was quite instructive. They were living the low-energy life, no bright streetlights, no neon signs or advertising at all. My West German hosts were still shaking their heads in disbelief. Their government discovered the only thing keeping Russian troops in East Germany was this. The Soviet government was so bankrupt, it could not afford to bring the soldiers home. There was no housing for the troops back home. So German workers went into the Soviet Union to build apartment buildings for them. Then the Russian bases were closed. Is America headed toward the same state of bankruptcy? The United States has bases in over 100 countries. The government puts it all on a MasterCard. They borrow the whole cost from some other countries, the ones who manufacture consumer goods and provide the oil. In an article titled, Portrait of an Oil-Addicted Former Superpower, Michael Clare writes, whether we know it or not, the energy Berlin Wall has already fallen. The United States is an ex-superpower in the making. Today, Radio EcoShock welcomes a well-published author, professor, and expert on oil, militarism, and geopolitics. Michael T. Clare is a professor of peace and world security studies for the Five Colleges based in Massachusetts. He's a defense columnist for The Nation magazine. His books, Resource Wars and then Blood and Oil, explained our times just ahead of the time. And his newest book is Rising Powers, Shrinking Planet, The New Geopolitics of Energy. It has just come out, published by Metropolitan Books. Michael, thank you for taking the time to join us.
It's my pleasure.
Well, the issues you cover are as wide as the world itself, so I'd like to zero in on one of those factoids that seems to speak volumes. You write that every day the average GI in Iraq uses approximately 27 gallons of petroleum-based fuels. Well, that's over 4 million gallons a day. I wonder, while Americans are sweating out high gas prices at the pumps, are they actually competing with their own military for oil?
I guess in a sense, in terms of everybody is competing on the planet for what supplies are available, and that, of course, is boosting up the price. Of course, the GIs in Iraq get most of their oil from the Middle East, and Americans at home get their oil from a variety of sources, a lot of it from Canada and Mexico and Venezuela and Africa, so it may not technically be competing, but really we're all in the same boat here.
Well, I'm told the American military is the biggest single consumer of oil-based products in the world. We've got all these warships cruising around, thousands of Air Force flights, the Humvees, all that. What is the impact of this militarism on climate change, do you think?
Oh, my gosh. Well, obviously the consumption of fossil fuels, oil, natural gas, and coal together is the leading cause of global warming, and anything that intensifies the consumption of fossil fuels, like war making, is going to increase the pace of global warming. And I think there's no question that war because it uses equipment that is particularly fossil fuel intensive, is accelerating global warming. No question about that.
Well, getting to the economy, perhaps. We're told that banks and investors damaged the financial system with subprime loans, but you say high-priced oil really broke the bubble of this American housing dream. How can you explain that?
Well, I guess really it's a combination of many things, but if you look at American housing over the past quarter of a century, because Americans have this predilection, now this is fed by the media, by movies, by culture, we Americans, and maybe it's not too different in Canada, we Americans believe in the so-called American dream, which is that every family has to have a big house on a big plot of land, and the only way you could do that today is to be far from the center of the city, because that's the only affordable lands left in this country. All of the inner suburbs are already completely occupied. So all of the new housing developments built in the past quarter of a century are beyond the beltway, we say, beyond the ring roads that surround American cities, which means they're far distant from any public transit facilities, beyond any suburban railroads or any public transit, which means you have to drive long distances to get to work. And, of course, all those people who drove out to the suburbs to build their new dream houses, many of them bought SUVs in the craze to have giant SUVs. So you have people buying SUVs and huge mortgages they can't afford to get giant homes that need huge amounts of fuel to heat in winter and cool in summer, all simultaneously borrowing all this money when fuel was cheap. And all of a sudden, the price of fuel has skyrocketed and the cost of these mortgages has skyrocketed all at once. And I think that led to the subprime crisis that's now rocketing the financial world.
So to maintain that lifestyle and that dream, do you think that's directly linked to the wars that we're seeing in the Middle East?
In a way it is, because you cannot maintain that way of life, that American dream as it's called, without prolific supplies of cheap petroleum. And the only place in the world that has enough petroleum left to supply that way of life is the Middle East. It has two-thirds of what's left of the world's petroleum. Another tenth is in Africa, and another tenth is in the former Soviet Union. And there is no other place in the world that can satisfy, that can supply, sustain that way of life. And all of those areas that I described are inherently fractious. They're divided along ethnic lines. They're divided along religious grounds. They're dangerous. And so American policy has been to use military force to ensure that the United States has access to all of that oil. And so it has led, I would argue, to one war after another.
Well, you know, the U.S. Congress just approved another $165 billion for what I call George Bush's wars, but the government doesn't actually have that money. They borrow more, adding to the $9 trillion debt Americans owe, mostly to foreigners. What happens when China or one of these giant petrodollar pools in the Middle East refuse to loan us more, when they stop buying government bonds?
Well, that point will come when the world economy is in a state of utter collapse, because, or they're ready to face that prospect, because when those countries stop lending us money, that's the point at which they're ready to see the entire capitalist system collapse, because they depend on Americans buying their oil and buying their products as well. I mean, all of these countries have, in a way, become codependent with Americans in our profligate spending habits. That, unfortunately, is the state of the world that we've all we've all bought into at this point. It's all based on consumption, a lot of it generated by American consumption, U.S. consumption. So they lend us money, so we keep buying their products, their oil and their other products, and they cut off credit at their own risk.
We are talking with Professor Michael Clare, an expert on oil and militarism from the Five Colleges of New England. His new book is Rising Powers, Shrinking Planet, The New Geopolitics of Energy. So what is new in this book?
What I think I tried to show in my book is a couple of things, but one of them is the dramatic impact of China's rise, and after China, India, on the global struggle over what remains of the world's resources. Now, until very recently, I mean to the end of the 1990s, most of the world's resources were consumed by the older industrial powers, the United States, Canada, Europe, Japan, Europe, and the former Soviet Union, Russia, consume the overwhelming majority of the world's resources, whether we're talking about energy or minerals or timber, whatever, you name it, we consumed the lion's share of resources. Now, all of a sudden, you have a dramatic increase in demand coming from China especially, but India is following about a generation behind. China is now the world's leading consumer of things like iron and steel and copper and aluminum and coal and a whole lot of other things. The only thing the U.S. still leads in, by the way, is oil. The United States is still the world's leading oil consumer, but China's catching up in that too. And all of this is happening at a time when the world's stockpiles of many of these resources is coming up to very severe limits. We're probably at the point of peak oil, the point at which the world's oil producers can no longer increase the day-to-day supply of oil, and it reaches a peak of production and goes into decline. We're probably within a decade of peak natural gas. Coal probably will peak before the middle of this century. Uranium probably before the middle of this century as well. Copper, cobalt, many critical mineral resources are becoming in scarce supply. So you have a huge spurt in demand coming from the rising powers of the developing world just at the moment in which we're reaching the limits of the availability of many key resources. This is an extraordinary world crisis that nobody has thought about or planned for or anticipated, and I think it's going to create a global political and economic crisis, and that's what my book is about. Now, I focus on the military and geopolitical implications of that, but the implications are much greater than that.
Well, what is your take on the relationship between this militarism and climate change?
Well, exactly. All of this competition for resources is going to be the norm from now on, like the competition between the U.S. and China, which I think will be the focal point of this competition over the world's remaining supplies of oil, natural gas, uranium, and so on. Now, this competition will be exceedingly costly in the trillions of dollars if it goes the way I fear it will, with a naval arms race, a nuclear arms race, and so on, creating a atmosphere of fear and suspicion. We already see signs of this in Washington, where China is viewed as the enemy to come. If you consider the cost that this will entail in the trillions of dollars, this is money that will not be available to spend on the energy conversion that will be necessary to avert global climate change. So there's a one-to-one relationship between a military competition with China over energy and solving the global warming crisis. You cannot do both.
Well, you know, this really worries me because China's an ancient civilization. It has a real sense of itself as a people. Is anyone in the administration or the military-industrial complex still crazy enough to believe the Chinese people are going to welcome American troops with flowers if a military action does happen? What do you feel about that?
Well, I don't think it's going to result in a direct clash. That's not the scenario that I project. Rather, I see proxy wars arising in Africa, the Middle East, and Central Asia as the U.S. and China back rival powers like Sudan, Angola, Nigeria, Libya, Kazakhstan, Azerbaijan, Iran, Iraq, and so on. We already see this pattern unfolding where the U.S. and China are providing arms and military support to opposing local powers in their mutual pursuit of energy, and this would lead to regional clashes that then get out of control and provoke a direct conflict. So I see something much more like World War One or the years leading up to World War One, rather than a direct clash between the U.S. and China.
Can you talk to us a bit more about the new rise of Russia and what that means for Americans?
Exactly. This is another aspect of this pre-World War I-like situation that I fear is arising. In the years before World War I, you had three great empires in collision, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Russian Empire, and the British Empire. And the same sort of three-way struggle is developing now in Central Asia, the Caucasus, and the Caspian Sea area with the United States, Russia, and China, all now competing for geopolitical advantage. And you have U.S. bases, you have Russian bases in the area, and China now is providing arms and equipment. All of them are providing arms and equipment to these countries and to breakaway ethnic enclaves like Abkhazia, which Russia is backing. So this is a very dangerous stew, much like the Balkans in the years that led up to the Sarajevo assassination that triggered World War One.
I think a lot of Americans are hoping for a big change in administration and perhaps bringing some troops home from Iraq. And yet some peace activists are really dispirited because there's so few signs of public protest these days, no big rallies. Why do you think that is?
Well, now, many people who have been active against the war and have been involved in protests are backing one or another of the candidates. Some have supported Hillary Clinton. I would say many more are backing Barack Obama, hoping that he will bring troops home from Iraq. He has pledged that if elected president, he will begin the withdrawal of American troops from Iraq. So I think that energy has moved into the political campaign. Whether or not this will achieve that result is another question, but I think there's tremendous energy that's gone into the political campaign, especially among young people who have flocked to Barack Obama, and I find that a very exciting phenomenon.
Do you have some recommendations coming out of your new book, Rising Power, Shrinking Planet?
Well, my fear, as I've said in this interview, is the most dangerous scenario we could expect is a new Cold War or a new arms race between the U.S. and China over energy. So my conclusion from that is that the U.S. and China need to work together in developing energy alternatives. In my mind, I'll put this out there, in my mind, this is the only way the global warming threat will ever be addressed, because U.S. and China are the world's two biggest consumers of energy, especially coal, and it's U.S. and Chinese coal use that is going to be the leading source of global warming gases. Overwhelmingly, the U.S. and China are going to be the leading emitters of carbon dioxide from their use of coal. So if we don't get these two countries to work together in curbing their use of coal and other fossil fuels, there's no hope of averting global climate change. And so I strongly urge cooperation between the U.S. and China in developing climate-friendly energy alternatives, thereby averting global environmental catastrophe and a new arms race.
A kind of a peace conversion that could save the planet. Do you have a website, or can you recommend one where people can find out more about you and your book?
Yes, the place that I do most of my writing is called TomDispatch.com, as in Thomas, TomDispatch.com.
Good. And I just want to finally sort of ask you, is there something I've missed? Is there something else you want our listeners to really think about?
Well, I think that people have to recognize the importance of the risk that the militarization of energy is taking off. The U.S. really is committed to using military force to get energy, especially in the Middle East and Africa, with the creation of a new Africa Command. I don't know if your listeners are aware that this year the U.S. is activating a new military command for Africa called AFRICOM, and I believe that this is tied to America's growing reliance on African energy, and this is the direction we're headed in.
Michael Clare is the author of Rising Powers, Shrinking Planet, The New Geopolitics of Energy from Metropolitan Books. And I want to thank you personally for educating me over the years and a million others like me. And thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock.
With information that will never be reported, disregard the mainstream media distorted. We come and listen and support it.
Professor Michael Clare doesn't yet compare the weakening of American power with the collapse of the former Soviet Union. Others are looking to that example, though, for sure. Dmitry Orlov lived through the fall of the Soviet Empire. He has a new book, Reinventing Collapse, The Soviet Example and American Prospects. After some delay, that book is finally available. The publisher is New Society. This book on collapse emerged from a series of articles titled Post-Soviet Lessons for a Post-American Century, appearing on a website, From the Wilderness, hosted by Michael C. Rupert. Rupert was a former cop who dedicated himself to investigating political cover-ups and conspiracies. In August of 2006, Rupert mysteriously disappeared, saying he no longer felt safe in the United States after various threats and break-ins. His archive is still on the net at fromthewilderness.com. Anyway, Orlov outlines five stages or signs of collapse, which I will read from his blog. Then we'll hear a short clip from Orlov taken from the Sea Realm podcast, hosted by KMO. In his blog, Orlov writes, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross defined the five stages of coming to terms with grief and tragedy as denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance, and applied it quite successfully to various forms of catastrophic personal loss, such as the death of a loved one, sudden end to one's career, and so forth. Several thinkers, notably James Howard Kunstler, and more recently John Michael Greer, have pointed out that the Kubler-Ross model is also quite terrifyingly accurate in reflecting the process by which society as a whole, or at least the informed and thinking parts of it, is reconciling itself to the inevitability of a discontinuous future, with our institutions and life support systems undermined by a combination of resource depletion, catastrophic climate change, and political impotence. Well, here are the five stages.
Stage 1.
Financial collapse. Faith in business as usual is lost. The future is no longer assumed to resemble the past in any way that allows risk to be assessed, and financial assets to be guaranteed. Financial institutions become insolvent, savings are wiped out, and access to capital is lost.
Stage 2.
Commercial collapse. Faith that the market shall provide is lost. Money is devalued and/or becomes scarce. Commodities are hoarded. import and retail chains break down, and widespread shortages of survival necessities become the norm.
Stage 3.
Political collapse, faith that the government will take care of you, is lost. As official attempts to mitigate widespread loss of access to commercial sources of survival necessities fail to make a difference, the political establishment loses legitimacy and relevance.
Stage 4.
Social collapse. Faith that your people will take care of you is lost, as local social institutions, be they charities or other groups that rush in to fill the power vacuum, run out of resources, or fail through internal conflict.
Stage 5.
Cultural collapse. Faith in the goodness of humanity is lost. People lose their capacity for kindness, generosity, consideration, affection, honesty, hospitality, compassion, and charity. That's a quote from Turnbull, the mountain people. Families disband and compete as individuals for scarce resources. The new motto becomes, "May you die today so that I die tomorrow." That's from Solzhenitsyn, the Gulag Archipelago. There may even be some cannibalism, end quote from Dmitry Orlov. Now, Orlov doesn't predict cannibalism as a future for America. He just says some societies have reached terrible stages, and he gives examples in his book from the dislocated African tribe described in another book, The Mountain People, by Colin M. Turnbull. Hopefully, by learning from previous cases of collapse, we can learn how to do better as individuals and as a society. But we shouldn't wait until things drop down to the bottom, to the pit of collapse. Find out more about Dmitry Orlov from his blog at cluborlov.blogspot.com. Orlov is spelled O-R-L-O-V. Let's hear just a couple of minutes from KMO's Sea Realm podcast, number 96, for May 14th, 2008. KMO and Orlov are discussing whether the people of the Soviet Union were actually better situated for collapse of their system.
You're listening to the Sea Realm Podcast, blowing your mind one week.
Welcome back
to
the Sea Realm Podcast. I'm your host, KMO, and joining me here in the Sea Realm once again is Dmitry Orlov. Dmitry is the author of Reinventing Collapse, The Soviet Example and American Prospects. Well, in the language of collapse that you've laid out with these five stages, would you describe the experience of the Soviet Union in the 90s?
Well, it's actually, you know, the Soviet collapse was in some ways collapse light, in some ways. And, you know, there were some severe social dislocations. There was a spike in the mortality rate. But basically, Soviet society did not really have any sort of financial basis to it. Most of the financial problems had to do with inability to continue importing as much food and consumer products as they were used to, they became accustomed to while oil prices were high and while oil production was booming. But unlike the United States, there wasn't a lot of personal finance. You know, people really were just given everything they needed to live. Money just didn't play that important a role. Commercial collapse was definitely something that I myself, you know, so one summer I showed up there and there was no food in the stores, and, you know, most of the stores were just closed. There weren't the usual lines everywhere. You know, there was some food you could buy at open air markets and such, but it was too expensive for a lot of people. There were people, middle class people, looking for food in the garbage. You know, that's about the worst that I've seen. And so commercial collapse definitely affected it. Political collapse, of course, occurred in the dramatic disappearance of the Soviet Union, but what came out of it is Russia, which for a time had a fairly weak central government and had some rather unsuccessful experiments with devolving authority to the regions, where regional governors were for a time elected, and with some very mixed results. And there was some separatist movements that gained traction for a time. But it wasn't a wholesale political collapse. In terms of social collapse, Russian families turned out to, you know, have quite a bit of strength to them, and the culture turned out to be rather resilient in some ways. But there was a great number of people who had bought into the Soviet system and were shocked to discover that it went away. And a lot of the people that were active and had careers in the Soviet times, who found themselves completely sidelined, just lost their weight, and a lot of them drank themselves to death. There were a lot of suicide. There was just a lot of despair and disorientation. And I think that's something that is almost unavoidable, but to some extent it's preventable. And that's one of the things that I would like to achieve, you know, for myself and others, you know, is the understanding that, you know, life goes on and you just adapt, and it's not really all that important to be so fully vested in the status quo at the moment.
That was Dmitry Orlov. His new book, just released, is Reinventing Collapse, The Soviet Example and American Prospects. Usually Orlov includes a lot of practical survival tips for hard times, as well as an intellectual framework to understand this process of decay when a system has become corrupt. You can hear that full interview at crealm.org. That's the letter c-realm.org. I'm Alex Smith, and I've got a little tune for you here from the new Love album. It's a remix of the Beatles, and it's really fine. Is anybody sorry the old Soviet Union is gone? They kept massive millions of their own people in prisons. Interrogators used torture. The press was censored and distorted to propaganda. You wouldn't want to live under a government like that.
Today, Ronald Reagan abolished the Fairness Doctrine as a favor to the Christian right, which was already plotting the takeover of AM radio, and as a favor to the studio heads who had helped him get elected, who were plotting the takeover of all media. And today, as a result of that, there are five giant international or multinational corporations who control all 14,000, virtually all 14,000 radio stations in America, all 5,000 television stations, 80% of our newspapers, all of our billboards, and most of the large internet content providers. So there are five guys who are deciding what we hear as news and information. And the news departments have become corporate profit centers. They no longer have an obligation to promote the public interest. Their only obligation is to their shareholders. And they serve that obligation not by telling us the difficult issues that we need to understand, like, you know, what happens when you privatize Social Security, and how did the pharmaceutical companies end up controlling Medicaid and Medicare, and, you know, what is global warming, and all of these issues. But rather by cutting costs, and guess what? Where did they cut costs? They cut costs by firing all of their investigative reporters. 80% of investigative reporters have lost their jobs over the past 15 years. The people who could connect the dots between the money that came from the corporate polluters to the White House, then the rollbacks that were engineered by the White House, and the children that you see, the asthmatic kids that you see in New York City and all over this country. Nobody's making those connections. Nobody's connecting the dots. So you see the asthmatic kid, and you're not saying the White House has something to do with that. The fact that in 19 states you can no longer safely eat any freshwater fish caught in the state because of mercury contamination coming from coal-burning power plants that were supposed to have removed 90% of that mercury 5 years ago, but the White House, having accepted $48 million from that industry, rolled back those rules. So then now there are 19 states, all of the freshwater fish are unsafe to eat, and in 49 states, some of the freshwater fish, including New York, which most of them are unsafe to eat. The only state where all the freshwater fish are safe to eat is Wyoming, where the Republican-controlled legislature has refused to appropriate the money to test the fish. But in all the other states, some or most or all of them are unsafe to eat. According to CDC, one out of every six American women now has so much mercury in her womb, one out of every six, that her children are at risk for a grim inventory of diseases, autism, blindness, mental retardation, heart, liver, and kidney disease. My levels of mercury are 2.5 times what EPA considers safe just from eating fish. And all of this could have been stopped except that that Bush abolished the mercury rule. But there's no, but Americans don't know that. I go and buy my fishing license for $30 a year, every year in New York State, and I get the fish advisories, which are now this thick, that basically say there's only, you know, a few places where you can safely fish in New York State. I read through that thing and I'm saying, that son of a bitch, George Bush. But most fishermen who buy that thing don't make the connection. The reason that they don't make the connection is because there's no investigative reporters out there telling them about that connection.
That was Robert Kennedy Jr. telling it like it is from a YouTube video, a message to the American people. And that is why you need alternative media, underground radio, and people like our next guest, Bruce Gagnon.
There's a Vietnam vet with a cardboard sign sitting there by the left turn line. Flag on his wheelchair flapping in the breeze, one leg missing and both hands free. No one's paying much mind to him. The VA budget's just stretched so thin, and now there's more coming back from the Mideast war. We can't make it here anymore.
Does anybody remember the peace dividend? People all over the world want the United States to take a leadership role in cleaning up fossil fuel emissions before we lose this livable climate. Our next guest, Bruce Gagnon, says America has far different plans. Instead of converting the economy, the military-industrial complex will war its way to control over the world's energy through domination of space. Bruce Gagnon is a senior fellow at the Nuclear Policy Research Institute and coordinator of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. Find that at spaceforpeace.org. Bruce, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Yes, hello. Good to be with you.
Well, you're connected now to an environment crowd, people who know the score about global warming and scarce oil. I noticed in an article last year you boiled it down to this stark choice, global warming or conversion of the military-industrial complex. What did you mean by that?
Well, what I mean is all evidence points to the fact that we have to have very quickly a new, whole new orientation about how we run our societies, because virtually everything we do in our industrial societies is oil-based. And it's going to take a massive, massive investment if we're going to save the planet, essentially, and save life for the future generations. We're going to have to massively invest and change the way we live and everything else. And so the question then becomes, where is that money going to come from at a time where, just in my country, in the United States, we're seeing the Pentagon controlling over 50 cents out of every federal tax dollar. And the Pentagon saying that in the coming years, our role under corporate globalization in the United States will be security export. And they lay that out, meaning that we're going to be out there fighting endless war to control the resources of the world, the oil, the diminishing supplies of water, markets, things like that. And so, and just in recent days, friends in Canada have told me that your country has dramatically increased its military spending as well, and will very likely be cutting back on things like national health care and other social programs. So this model of the United States becoming the military arm of corporate globalization is growing. And we know that the Pentagon is also saying that in order to literally control the world, they're going to need space technology to do that, which they say will be the largest industrial project in the history of the planet Earth. And so we know, too, that the United States is now going to our allies in Canada and England and Germany and Italy and Australia and Japan and saying, you know, this thing's going to be so expensive that we, even the United States, can't afford it by ourselves. We need you to come on side with us, help us pay for it, cut your social programs as well. So the question then becomes, how will any of the industrial societies really be able to afford to dramatically change our footprint when we're investing more and more and more money in military production.
Well, I should tell listeners you have a couple of very compelling videos out on YouTube and on your own site. One is the movie Arsenal of Hypocrisy, the space program and the military-industrial complex. That one is just downright scary. Everyone should see it, I think. But I was also moved by your passionate speech at the Veterans for Peace Convention in Seattle in 2006. That video on YouTube was real education for me. I want to tell you just for a second why. The thing is, a couple of weeks ago, I did a program on capital flight, how the super rich and the corporations are pouring their money into tax havens instead of paying taxes to help build their home countries. Well, after hearing that Seattle speech, I just felt so naive. As things now stand, even if we get the wealthy to pay their fair taxes, those billions won't go to create new green jobs or save the climate, will they?
Well, you know, there's so many dibs right now on that money. Every politician in America who's running for office these days is saying, well, you know, when we get in there, when the Democrats get back the presidency, we're gonna start taxing the rich again, and they're going to pay for everything with it. They're going to pay for health care. They're going to pay for education. They're going to pay for home heating assistance, retooling the infrastructure, you know, roads and bridges and everything else. So there's so many dibs on that money now that I can't imagine how there's going to be much left to do anything in a big way. Just the other night I was watching a speech by Obama from Montana that is just getting ready to hold its presidential primary, and he was saying that he wanted to use this money to invest in green jobs. He said, I want to spend $100 billion over 10 years. Well, we're right now spending $12 billion, the U.S. is spending $12 billion a month in Iraq. Well, that's $144 billion a year. And he wants to spend $100 billion over 10 years on green technology, you know, solar, wind, rail, tidal, all that stuff. Well, that's not enough. That's not a dramatic change. That's a very incremental change, much too slow to deal with the reality that we have facing us today.
We're talking with Bruce Gagnon, a longtime anti-war campaigner. You can find his blog at spaceforpeace.blogspot.com. You know, in your movies about the military plans, you also point out that space itself is really a very sensitive environment. We hear about protecting the Amazon or Antarctica, but not the space around this planet. What are the environmental problems out there?
Well, it's a very important point, and it's one that the environmental community is paying little attention to. Right now, there's all kinds of space debris or space junk up there, so much that it is all tracked on the big radar screens by the Pentagon, big radar tracking devices that are measuring even things as small as tiny specks of paint. And they say it's gotten so bad now that the International Space Station that's being built just above the planet Earth, on a couple of occasions they've had to move it because space junk was coming dangerously close to it, and they thought it would actually destroy the International Space Station. And the Pentagon is now saying that it, and scientists are saying that it won't be much longer if we continue the way we're going, that we will create so much space junk that we literally will not be able to get a rocket off the planet Earth. It will be entombed to the planet because it will be like a minefield above the Earth, so much space junk orbiting the Earth. But in spite of that knowledge, the Pentagon is still going forward with plans to put weapons in space to destroy other countries' satellites so that the United States military can control and dominate space. Also, there are nuclear devices in space launched over many years by the former Soviet Union and the United States. Many of these are going to tumble back to Earth in the coming years. Some of them, these military satellites powered with plutonium, some of them powered with uranium. And when they tumble back to Earth and they burn up on reentry, guess what? The deadly toxic materials on board are dispersed as basically dust across the planet to be inhaled by the people. And then on top of that, the U.S. space program has plans to dramatically escalate the number of launches of nuclear materials in the coming years. They want to have nuclear-powered mining colonies on the moon and Mars. They want to have nuclear rockets with actual nuclear reactors for engines, taking spacecraft out to Mars, because they say nuclear reactors will cut in half the amount of time it'll take to get to Mars, will allow them to lift more weight, to carry larger payloads for eventual mining operations. And then the military has long been saying that to power lasers in space, orbiting battle stations, they would need nuclear reactors. And so the nuclear industry views space as a new market. Well, routinely rockets have about a 10% failure rate when they're launched. So imagine a whole host of these nuclear launches over the years to come, powered or carrying nuclear devices on board. This is a grave, grave danger. So we've got to begin to look at space as an environment that needs to be protected from this bad seed of war and greed and environmental degradation.
You know, I heard a recent interview you did on a libertarian program, the Scott Horton Show, out of Austin, Texas, and I came out of that one thinking, my God, we all believe the Cold War madness of a nuclear holocaust is over. That's behind us. But you say the nuke missiles are back on hair triggers again. Talk to us about the American threats to China and Russia and how they are responding.
Well, today the U.S. military is surrounding Russia and China. In the case of Russia, Russia has the world's largest supply of natural gas, and they have very significant supplies of oil as well. It is the intention of the U.S. military to try to essentially take control over Russian resources, because obviously we understand that whoever controls the fossil fuels around the earth, especially as they begin to diminish, they will control the keys to the world's economic engine. So today the United States, through NATO, is expanding NATO eastward, building bases further and further and further into the former Warsaw Pact or Eastern Bloc countries, essentially now moving right up along to the border of Russia, wanting to now build NATO bases in Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia, right on the Russian border. At the same time, the United States is beginning a military encirclement of China, because the United States military intends to, quote-unquote, manage China, according to an article in the Washington Post a couple years ago. And so today, missile defense systems, as they're called, really nothing to do with defense at all, but they're part of the U.S. offensive first strike technology program underway, under development. These systems are being deployed in South Korea, Japan, likely will be even put into Taiwan if the military gets its way, and throughout the Asian Pacific region. And also at the same time, on China's inland border, the United States, since 9/11, has built 6 permanent bases in Afghanistan. And so this military move is underway today, and it's, again, a very expensive one. And they are taking and robbing the National Treasury of the United States in order to pay for this massive mobilization of a military around the world in order to control Russia and China.
You know, it's so sad to hear this about America. I mean, I'm not an American, but I've lived in the country and I've worked there. I've traveled every one of the 48 states. It's just a fantastic country with a lot of great people. Everywhere you go, you meet great people. And I think people around the world want to love America, but the snow job coming from the U.S. military is just mesmerizing. And it feels to an outsider like me that some sort of, I don't know, corporate military coup has taken over a good people and is misusing their power. What's your take? What is their game, if we had to sum it up? What's their game plan for this planet?
Well, I think your analysis is right on. It is a corporate takeover. It's a corporate coup d'etat. The corporations run our country. They run the government. They control the Congress. And they do it because it's all about maximizing their profits. Corporations are moving their jobs out of the United States so that they can go overseas to places like China or Indonesia or India so they can maximize their profits. They don't care about the American worker anymore. So I think you shouldn't hate the American people. you should hate the American government, if you will. The American people are extremely frustrated because they see our democracy being drowned right before our very eyes. We work so hard in the peace movement and in the environmental movement and other movements in this country to try to change policy in Washington, and we are over and over and over again beaten down by these corporate powers. And people have become, in many respects, dispirited as a result of this. They just don't know what to do, because everything that we've been taught about how you change policy in a democratic society has literally been taken away from us. The media is now under the control of these same corporate powers. So their agenda internationally is control and domination. I basically call it 21st century feudalism. This time, though, we get a car, we get a color TV, but it's feudalism from a corporate perspective. And I think this is not just happening in the United States. When I talk to my friends in Canada, and when I talk to them from Japan or Germany, recently I was in France, they told me the story about how the newspaper Le Monde had been bought up by a French weapons corporation. This corporate takeover of our governments and the drowning of our democracy is a international problem, and the only response that there can be must come from international organizing, where we support each other in our campaigns. No organizing anymore, I think, can just be national. All of our campaigns have to become international, just as we see on global warming and climate change. People are organizing internationally, because if you don't address the issue internationally, you don't get anywhere. And so the corporations are really moving away from the nation state. They're taking the power and centralizing it internationally, and we've got to respond to them by our own international efforts. And so that's why on the space issue, we have this global network against weapons and nuclear power in space. We recognized some years ago that we had to internationalize this issue about space technology if we were ever going to stop it.
I'm Alex Smith with anti-war activist and Space for Peace campaigner Bruce Gagnon. Bruce, we're starting to run out of time, but, you know, my other impression from the Scott Horton interview was your call for a lot of different groups to wake up and start acting together, you know, whether we're environmentalists or anti-war activists, labor leaders, libertarians, animal rights. It doesn't matter. We all have the same common problem that threatens to ruin the world. Do you see signs that these divisions are starting to break down and people want to work together?
Not enough, I'm sad to say. You know, in my country, I don't know about Canada, but the environmental community feels they have some relationship to, let's say, the Democratic Party in our country, real or perceived, I'm not sure. But many environmentalists will tell us privately that they agree with us on everything we're saying about the military. It's getting too strong. It's getting too much money. But that they don't want to publicly say anything about it because it would put them being critical of the Democrats, who are slavish to the military-industrial complex. And they say that would affect their relationship, their good relationship that they have with the Democrats on environmental issues. And so many environmentalists then, while privately they agree with us and they're our friends, publicly they don't want to be associated with us as we call for the conversion of the military-industrial complex. But we're saying there's not going to be any money to deal with the environment, to deal with the real challenges of climate change, unless we take on this issue of this military control, this military dominance of our culture. Just recently in Albuquerque, New Mexico, the base commander at Kirtland Air Force Base, this is a base that's in charge of developing the space lasers for war in space, the base commander went and met with the business community, had a luncheon with them, and he said, you know, we're having a problem. The Air Force budget is taking a hit because of the very expensive social programs, called Social Security and Medicare, which is health care for the elderly. And he says, you know, we're going to have to get those programs under control. Basically, it means drain the swamp so that we can move that money into the Air Force budget. And so we've got to begin to ask senior citizens and labor unions and environmentalists to show more courage to come out and begin to talk about this predominance of the military-industrial complex in our country and literally around the world.
What should Americans be doing with their tax dollars? What is the better dream for us all?
Well, I think that's one of our jobs, is to put out a positive alternative vision. You know, as jobs are leaving the country, as corporations are moving jobs out of the country, who is going to create, good jobs in America, if not the government, doing things like building a rail system? You know, if you've been to the United States, you know we don't have much of a public transit system in America, and we need one if we're going to deal with the effects of climate change. And so imagine if we were to convert our weapons industry plants to produce a rail system connecting every corner of the United States of America. Imagine the jobs that would be created. It would be massive. The same goes for a solar society. Why can't we be putting solar, at least water heaters, on every house and business in the country? Where I live in Maine, solar works even here, too. So imagine Florida, Texas, Southern California, Arizona, New Mexico. Imagine a solar society, and imagine the jobs created doing that kind of thing. Recently, I drove through Kansas, and there was just a massive amount of wind. In fact, they call it the Saudi Arabia of wind. Well, why couldn't there be a windmill in every single little town in Kansas? Imagine the jobs created building those windmills. So this is the kind of things that our dollars should be used for, rather than building weapons for endless war. But that isn't going to happen unless there's a unified demand made by, again, the peace movement, the environmental movement, the labor movement, the social justice movement, all who would benefit from this kind of reorientation of the American economy. We'd see peace, we'd see environmental change, we would see more jobs for the labor unions, we'd see more social justice as more people were working and coming off unemployment. It would benefit all the movements. So this is a demand that has to be made over and over and over again until the American people begin to make it their own.
Well, it seems impossible, but it has to happen. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. You have just had a taste from more than 30 years' worth of relentless campaigning for a safer, more peaceful world from Bruce Gagnon. He's coordinator of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. Bruce, tell us quickly about your websites, your blog, and where to find your videos.
If you go to our website, which is spaceforpeace.org, spaceforpeace.org, in the menu, there's a section called Space Videos, and there you'll see, as you said, our documentary video called Arsenal of Hypocrisy. I highly recommend it, and I urge you to get other people to watch it as well. You'll have a much greater understanding about the plans that are now underway. And also, as you said, there are a number of my speeches in there from recent events that you can watch. At the same time, on our website, if you just scroll down a little bit, you'll see the link to my blog called Organizing Notes, where I basically tell stories from the day-to-day work. I do a lot of traveling. I tell stories of my traveling. And one can also order my book called Come Together Right Now, Organizing Stories from a Fading Empire. You can order that from the website as well.
You have heard it here. Educate yourself while you still can. And thank you so much, Bruce Gagnon, for all your dedication.
Thank you, Alex.
We opened with James McMurdy. We can't make it here anymore. Here is Mr. Sam Cooke. Speak to us, Sam.
It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will.
What will it be? Collapse or change or both? That's it for Radio EcoShock this week. Download the full Sea Realm interview with Dmitry Orlov from the Peak Oil page of our website at ecoshock.org. I appreciate all the college and community stations that rebroadcast this show and the 2,000 people who downloaded last week's program. Forget the networks. We are starting to roll.